The following audio presentation is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Family Studies as part of our monthly seminar series in which we showcase national and international research related to the family. The seminars are designed to promote a forum for discussion and debate. They are open to the public and free of charge.
Welcome to the Institute. My name is Ben Edwards and I'm the Executive Manager of Longitudinal Studies at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. I'd just like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, their elders past and present, who are traditional owners of the land on which we meet. Please remember to turn your mobile phones off or on silent. I think I've done mine, but if there is one, it'll be me. Bathrooms are accessible via the lift in the lobby, so if you're busting to go. Now these, but you can hold on. We can clean up afterwards. Bad joke. Unfortunately, this is being audio recorded, so that's going to be. Our presentation today will be audio recorded, and it's also a webinar. So I'm happy to say that we've got about 80 people on the webinar, so hello there in Paris, the OECD and various other places. It's great to have you with us. And we'll be providing, we hope to have a audio and version of the slides online, so for people to have access as a result going into the future. So in many ways, this is a bit like a birthday or the birth of a child in some ways, because the data will be released in the next month or so. So what we want to do is tell the story of the pre-birth conception story, I guess, of this new national longitudinal study, Building a New Life in Australia, the Longitudinal Study of Humanitarian Migrants. I'm going to be giving you a sort of outline of the rationale and then and a brief description of the sample and some of the study methodology characteristics, and Diana's going to tell you about some of the really interesting facets and challenges that we've had to face in conducting such a study. It's been a very challenging study, and I think the outcomes speak for themselves in terms of the cooperation rate and the quality of the information that we've collected. And then lastly, I'll be talking a little bit about some of the technical aspects of survey weighting and also the data itself. Firstly, though, just to say that any mistakes are our own and they don't represent those views of the Australian government or the Institute. So firstly, some acknowledgements. So the Department of Immigration and Citizenship commissioned the study in 2012, and with the machinery of government changes, with the election of a new government, it was moved across to the Department of Social Services. Without their support, the study wouldn't have been possible. The Institute's been managing the study, and many of the team and Diana has been managing it for the majority of the time and are in the room today. And also we've got representatives from Colmar Brunson Social Research who've done a terrific job in conducting the survey, and you'll see some of the challenges. And they've been working in conjunction with Multicultural Marketing and Management. So like all these large-scale studies, it's a team effort. To give you a bit of a background, many of you will be aware that humanitarian migrants are fleeing trauma and persecution. Many have spent many years in camp, in refugee camps or detention centres. And the journeys that people take to come to Australia can be varied and difficult, and we really need to know more and have more solid evidence so we can support better policies and programs. This is a really dynamic area, both politically in terms of policies, but also in terms of the nature of who the source countries from which people come to Australia. So having up-to-date, accurate evidence is really critical. So we really need to understand the factors that aid and hinder successful settlement, and we want to provide an evidence base for the research community and for public policy and service development. And that's the aims of the study. So in terms of why the study was established, There has been some longitudinal studies of immigrants in Australia in the past. So over a decade ago, there was LSIA2, and prior to that, LSIA1, both of which had a humanitarian migrant proportion of the sample. The proportion wasn't that large, and the sample of humanitarian migrants wasn't that large. And the time in which they were, these new immigrants to Australia were followed wasn't that long. So the most recent one, they're only followed for 18 months. So that's one of the things that distinguishes this study, in that it's specifically focused on humanitarian migrants, and we're following people for up to 5 years at this stage. And as I mentioned before, it's a dynamic, the sources of migrants to Australia, humanitarian migrants to Australia, have changed. So 15 years ago, people from Vietnam, Yugoslavia, Iraq, 10 years ago, Bosnia and Croatia and Iraq, and then more recently, Afghanistan, Iraq, Burma and Sri Lanka. So whilst the overall size of our humanitarian migrant intake hasn't changed that much, there's some things that have changed. And one of the changes and the initiatives for the study was the growth of onshore arrivals, commonly referred to as illegal maritime arrivals. That was one of the other reasons why this survey was established, to try to understand whether the pathways were different or varied for that group as well. So just to give you a brief overview of the study survey methodology. So it's a 5-year longitudinal study. There are annual data collections, but they vary. So the initial baseline survey was conducted in the home, and then a telephone interviews a year later, a shorter survey, and then another interview in the home, which will be happening later on this year, and then a telephone survey the year after, and then finally the home visit at the time in which people will be eligible for citizenship. So we're spanning the first 5 years of people's lives in Australia. We're following individuals or multiple members of from families from their early months in Australia to their eligibility of citizenship, and they're from across all states in Australia and in urban and regional centres. In terms of the background, for those who are not aware of the policies around this, there's two main pathways by which people can get to Australia, offshore and onshore. So offshore, mainly the settlement to people who are overseas through the UNHCR, who are identified and referred. And the visa subclasses are 200 to 204, it's the technical point to note for the first forthcoming slides. Onshore pathways are for those who want to apply for protection after they've arrived in Australia. So that's commonly people who've arrived by boat or by plane. And this is visa subclass 866. In terms of the recruitment process for the study, we were lucky to be able to have access to administrative data base from the Department of Immigration and Citizenship, the settlement database, and this enabled us to sample from that database and to approach people. So Coleman Brunson sent out postcards and letters prior to the start of the fieldwork, and they obtained consent through the principal applicant. So the principal applicant is the person who is the main applicant for humanitarian visa. And on that, there might be multiple people applying who are referred to as secondary applicants, and we refer to that group as the migrating unit. What we did for the survey is translate survey materials into 14 different languages, which is a huge challenge in terms of time, but also for a variety of different reasons, and Diana's going to talk about that in a little bit later. The interviewers had to be bilingual, so Coleman Brunson had to recruit and retain high-quality interviewers who were able to conduct social research and ask quite sensitive questions. So the training and the nature of the survey sample meant that it was quite a challenging group. And then another novel feature of our recruitment process was the community engagement officers, who are people who are respected in the local community, who could help advocate, recruit, and be a sort of a conduit to conduct the first survey. And that was really important in that initial stages. As you can see, the obtained sample are from across Australia. We had 11 sites where we conducted interviewing. In terms of the actual sample that was recruited, there were 2,400 almost 2,400 individuals recruited. The majority were from the metropolitan areas. A touch over 50, over half were male. Principal applicants consisted of the majority of our individuals, so 1509, and most were from the offshore pathway. So initially we had intended to interview 30% onshore. There was a change when we were actually recruiting the sample of government policy in mid-June 2013, which meant that any people who arrived onshore were processed in Manus Islands and Nauru, and that meant that we got a lower participation rate for those groups because they weren't available, basically. We maximised that as much as possible, but they just weren't available. We had a number of secondary adult applicants and also adolescent applicants, and I'm pleased to say that in wave three we'll also be collecting information about their children as well, which is really an exciting prospect. Really diverse profile, so migrants are from 35 different countries. The majority are from the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan and Iran, but there's a huge number of languages spoken at home, over 49 languages are spoken at home, the majority being Arabic, Assyrian and Persian. So there's a wide array of cultural diversity and religion in this sample, and a wider range of ages too. So we had someone who was 80 years of age who was interviewed, so very broad age range as well. So quite a heterogeneous sample. In terms of the composition of the migrating unit, there was quite a varied composition, particularly for the offshore. For the onshore arrivals, we're talking mainly about a single person, so over 80% were single persons. And then the second most prevalent group there was the couple families with children under the age of 18. When we turn to the offshore arrivals, a much more complex picture. So we have single person migrating units, that's a touch over 30%. But then we have one in four couple families with children under the age of 18. And then some who have children as well as other family members. So quite complex family types there. I'll give you a little bit of time to have a look through that in terms of the household composition. I mean, I think there's some very interesting. So we've got quite large households. I can't recall what the largest household we, in terms of migrating unit, was it 8 interviews?
Nine
in the unit. So quite large things. Now I'll pass over to Diana, who's going to talk about the challenges.
Can you hear me? Okay. Thanks everyone for coming along today and for listening in. It's really a privilege to be involved in this study. And it's also been an exciting one and a challenging one at various times. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the challenges that we faced in undertaking a study like this. And then I'm going to move on to talking about what we actually measured. So what were the topics that we measured and what some of the questions were. And when I'm doing that, I'm going to give you some examples of some of the answers that people could choose. But of course, I won't be telling you all the answers. So just remember that it's a selected group of answers that I'm going to mention. So as Ben's already pointed out, it's a very diverse population and also highly vulnerable, as we'll see later on. So we found that many participants had little or no education, and we had expected this and prepared for it. We found that some had never completed a questionnaire like this in their lives, and so this was really a challenge for them. And some of them had difficulty understanding the more complex concepts. For example, we asked questions about how they'd been feeling over the last 12 weeks, and they struggled with being able to answer whether they were feeling a certain way all the time, most of the time, some of the time, or never. So this was a challenge for some of the people in our sample. We sort of take this for granted when we're doing our research, but for a population of this kind, it was a challenge. And there were also cultural sensitivities that we needed to bear in mind. So we needed to respect people's cultural practices when we visited their homes, and we needed to think about matching the language and the gender of interviewers and participants where we could. So these were complicating factors, if you like, that you really need to be conscious of when you're undertaking research such as this. Ben has already talked about the need to translate into languages, and we translated into 14 differing languages for Wave 1. We selected these languages based on an analysis of the settlement database and who was going to be available in the selected sites, so that we thought that these languages would give coverage of at least three quarters of the people that we would be approaching. And we did find that more than 90% of the surveys were completed in a language other than English, with Arabic the most common, followed by Persian, Dari and Nepali. We used some innovative approaches to increase the accessibility of the survey. So as well as written translations, we had audio recordings, again into the 14 languages. And as the audio recording was playing, the words were being highlighted on the screen, and this was an aid to increase the accessibility of the survey to have an audio prompt and a visual prompt for respondents. The survey was presented on small Surface Pro computer tablets, and these could be completed by the participants themselves, or they could be administered by a bilingual interviewer. And the interviewers had two computer tablets available that they took to the home. So this means that two people could answer the survey at once, which was an asset in increasing confidentiality, but also limiting the time in the home. And before participants started on their surveys, they did a short demonstration session which got them familiar with how the Surface Pro worked, and also about the differing types of responses that they would be needing to use. So translations of the surveys were obviously really vital, but it really was a complex job, and there were some technical issues that our Colmar Brunson colleagues had to overcome, and they did so very well. So we found that some of the languages that we might have been interested in translating weren't supported by the software, for example, Karen Segal. But fortunately, we found that in a lot of these instances, the respondents had another language that wasn't on our translated list that they could do the survey in. And if they couldn't do a survey in a translated language, then we used an interpreter to assist with the interview. As you probably expect, there was variation in whether the languages ran left to right and right to left. And this was tricky for the programming staff, because they are not able to check the languages themselves, they're English speakers. And so we needed to have the translators involved in another step to check that what had been programmed up was actually working the way it should. And so this was another element of complexity that got introduced. And while we found the audio recordings were a great asset, there were occasionally some issues around dialects and accents for some respondents. In a study like this, there's a need for questions that may be sensitive and upsetting for participants. To understand the challenges that people face, we need to understand what they've gone through. So we really carefully considered what we could ask and tried to limit the number of sensitive questions asked, but nevertheless there were a bunch of sensitive questions. And the topics that interviewers told us had been sensitive participants were their experiences of past trauma, having family who are not in Australia yet but who are waiting to come, the questions on mental health and post-traumatic stress, and the standard income questions that virtually all studies use. It was important for interviewers to reassure participants that their answers would be confidential and kept private and wouldn't affect their permanent visa status or their access to services and government benefits. And this was really important reassurance that needed to be made. Now I'm going to move on to talking about what actually is in the survey. And I first wanted to say that, like many of longitudinal studies, we're taking a very broad lens. So we're trying to look at quite a number of the factors that affect people's settlement success as well as the various ways in which settlement services and settlement success can be measured. Most of these we are carrying forward to ways 2 and 5. 2 to 5. Not 2 and 5. So first of all, demographic information. So principal applicants answered quite a number of questions, as did the other applicant types, but a lot of this information was collected only from principal applicants, and this was information about themselves and others on their country of birth, age, gender, how they were related to the principal applicant, and whether they were living with the principal applicant or elsewhere. We also asked whether they were sharing their residence with other people who were not on their visa application, and their marital or relationship status, and whether they had other children who were not living with them. It's an important fact to know that. And finally, we collected a history of the different countries they lived in before they came to Australia. Another main area was housing and neighbourhood. So here we asked whether they'd received help in finding housing, such as help from settlement caseworkers or family or friends or community groups and so on, and how helpful the assistance had been. We also asked how easy it had been for them to find housing in Australia and barriers to finding housing, such as not having a rental history or references, as you can imagine, or cost or language difficulties, or even understanding the process. We asked how often they'd moved home since arriving in Australia and why they'd chosen their current home. And this could have ranged from the fact that they'd been placed there by the settlement service, or it was for family or community or work reasons. We also asked details about their current home, whether it was temporary or they were on a contract or lease or another arrangement, and whether they were paying rent, a loan or a mortgage, or there was no money passing hands. And we asked about their satisfaction with aspects of the home, and these were characteristics such as the number and size of rooms, the facilities that were in the home, whether they were close to shops, public transport or schools, and lastly, some fairly standard questions about their neighbourhood, whether they found people to be friendly, it had parks or playgrounds, it was a good place to bring up children, and they felt safe in the neighbourhood. English language proficiency was a major interest, and here we asked about their English language proficiency as well as their proficiency in their own language. So we asked, as well as asking about the main language they spoke at home, we asked how well they read and write in their main language. And then we asked about how well, before they'd come to Australia, how well they'd understood English, used English themselves, read in English or wrote in English. And we repeated those questions to ask about their English language proficiency at the time of the Wave 1 interview. We also asked whether they'd taken English language classes since they arrived and where they'd taken classes, such as the AMEP, the LLMP services, and how helpful they'd found the English courses they'd taken. And we know that interpreting assistance can be a key need, especially at this time and early months in Australia. So we asked about whether they'd needed interpreting assistance and been able to get it, for what purpose, how helpful has it been, and if they hadn't been able to get an interpreting assistance, why not? Was it because they didn't know how to obtain it, or a service wasn't available, or it was too expensive? Another area that we looked at is other education and training that they may be undertaking. And while we wouldn't have expected this to be very high in Wave 1, we would expect that as the wave continues that this will grow. So here we asked what the highest level of education was that they'd completed before they came to Australia, and if it was post-secondary, what their main area of study was and qualification. We asked whether, if they had qualifications, they'd been assessed and what the outcome was. And if they had a qualification and hadn't had it assessed, why hadn't they had it assessed? And turning next to whether they were currently studying, we asked whether they were taking another course of study apart from English, the type of course being undertaken, and the area of study, if it had a major area of study. And finally, in this area, we asked what their long-term educational aspirations were, what level of education they hoped to achieve in the end. Employment and income was a very large area, as you might imagine. There are other areas that are also quite large, but employment and income is probably one of the larger ones. But in wave one, a lot of the employment questions were not relevant because it was early months in Australia and not so many were in employment. So we expect that as the waves go by, this will become a much more intensive area of examination. So, here we asked what their prior occupation had been before they came to Australia, if they had an occupation and they'd been in paid work. We also asked if they'd been in unpaid work, so done things like volunteering or caring for families. And since they'd arrived in Australia, had they found it difficult to get work? And what was the total amount of time that they'd actually spent in work, in paid work? And we use standard ABS type employment questions, so whether they've been in paid work in the last 7 days, the number of current paid jobs they had, what their main occupation currently was, what their employment conditions were, and the hours worked per week, and the income received in a nutshell. We asked how satisfied they were with the job that they were in at the moment, and if they were dissatisfied, what the reasons were. So was it the hours worked? Not enough? Too much? The pay, the distance to travel, or was it a poor match for their experiences and skills? We also asked about looking for work. So what avenues had they used? Had they used Centrelink or the settlement caseworker or community links or family or friends, and how helpful these had been? So migrants on permanent protection visas are able to access a range of government benefits, and so we asked about the benefits they were receiving. And finally, we asked what their total after-tax income was from all sources. And to further understand their financial situation, we had questions about whether they were sending money to family or friends outside Australia, or giving money to family or friends inside Australia, how much they sent or gave, and how regularly. And finally, in this particular module, we looked at whether they were under financial strain, asking about whether for lack of money they'd been unable to do things like pay gas or electricity bills, pay their rent or mortgage, gone without meals, or were they able to heat or cool their home, and so on. Another large area were their pre-migration experiences. And here we asked about whether they or other family members had experienced traumas such as war, physical or sexual violence, imprisonment or kidnapping, persecution, a natural disaster like a flood or a drought, extreme living conditions such as lack of food or water before they came to Australia. There were also questions about living in refugee camps or other types of detention, which family members were with them, whether they had adequate shelter, enough food, clean water, they felt safe, and so on, and what services they'd needed but hadn't been able to get. We also asked why they'd migrated to Australia. Were they placed here? Was it because they had family or friends here? Or was it because there were good living conditions or job opportunities? And they could choose a number of these answers from the list that we provided. Who they knew when they came here. We know this is a really important factor that helps people settle into a country to already have family or friends here. So we asked about this, and we also asked whether they still had family in another country waiting to come to Australia. Moving on to the area of physical and mental health, this was also another fairly large area. So we used two standard mental health scales, the 6-item Kessler Psychological Distress Scale and a short form of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Scale, from the Harvard Trauma Questionnaire. We had a series of questions on physical health. For instance, we had a general rating of their health in the past 4 weeks, whether physical health problems had affected their daily life or work, and whether they were experiencing bodily pain. We also asked if they had a long-term physical health disability, injury or condition that had lasted 12 months or more. And there were quite a number of items on the stresses that they'd experienced since they arrived, such as their work or family situation, fears about their family safety, and so on. There were also global questions about how difficult they were finding life in general and how well they felt they were coping. Self-sufficiency was another important criteria of settlement success. So here we're looking at how well they're able to carry out basic daily tasks that will affect, you know, how they live their lives. So we asked about things like whether they felt that they were capable of looking for a job, using public transport, getting help in an emergency, using bank services, finding out about their rights, and accessing government services and benefits and getting help from police. We also asked whether they experienced barriers in accessing government services, such as not even knowing where to get help, or fears that their information wouldn't be kept private, or long waiting lists. Community support and community connections was another key area for us. And here we asked about how much support participants had received from their national, ethnic and religious communities in Australia, as well as from other community groups beyond these groups. We also asked whether they took part in activities within their national, ethnic and communities and other communities, such as whether they attended festivals or special days, or they were volunteered or were members of parent or youth groups and so on. We asked how easy they found it to make friends in Australia, understand our ways, talk to their Australian neighbours, and how easy these things have been for their children as well. And also whether they felt they'd been made welcome in Australia and whether they felt part of the Australian community. People come with all sorts of different qualities and personal characteristics, and we know that a sense of confidence and a sense that you can do it, it can be an important support in settling in a new country. So we asked a number of questions here about their self-concept and self-efficacy. Things like, I'm able to do things as well as most people. I can handle whatever comes my way. We also asked about their levels of trust in different community groups and organisations, such as people in their neighbourhood, people in the wider Australian community, the police, and so on. We asked whether they'd been discriminated, stopped from doing something, been hassled or made to feel inferior because of their ethnicity, religion or skin colour. And if they had experienced discrimination, we asked where this had happened, and we had quite a long list of things, but they included things like on the street, being served in a shop, on public transport and so on. We asked whether they wanted to stay in Australia, and if not, why not, and where they would hope to go after Australia, and did they intend to apply for Australian citizenship when they became eligible. And the last topic that we looked at were their perceptions of life in Australia. Had their experiences lived up to their expectations on things like the quality of life, the sort of support that they've received, the job opportunities and access to education and so on. We asked about the aspects that they had found that made settling more difficult, and we had quite a long list that they could choose from. These were things like they didn't know anyone, their family members weren't happy, they were homesick, they weren't used to Australian ways. And we also asked what things had helped them settle in Australia. And these included things like they already had family here, they felt welcomed by the community and they felt safe. And don't forget that this is a group of humanitarian migrants who've come from very parlous circumstances, so feeling safe was a key issue for them. And we ended with some general questions, such as what their overall experience of settling in Australia had been so far. And this ranged from very good to very hard. And their thoughts on ways to improve programs and services for future humanitarian migrants. And so it's fair to say that this is a really valuable data set covering a whole range of areas that we are all very interested in pursuing. And we look forward to actually grappling with the data that comes out of the first wave of the study. And I'll hand it back to Ben here.
Thanks, Diana.
And yes, there is a lot of data that will be available.
Sorry guys, in the webinar. I'll just say I'm just talking about the analysis of the non-response and the extent to which the sample matches the non-response. And in the main it does, but there are some exceptions. So we had lower representation of those who were living in capital cities, those who had smaller sized families, those who were in the non-IMA visa subclass, those born in Burma, the rest of Africa, or rest of Asia, or Africa. And so what we've done to adjust for that is we've used this technique called survey weighting. It's this particular technique that we've used is rating. It's quite commonly used in most large-scale survey research. we've used the module in SATA to undertake it. It was first proposed by Jeannie and Stephen in 1940, and basically what that means is that we can re-represent the population proportions based on this rating or this weight. So we upweight those who we've underrepresented and downweight those who we've overrepresented, so the proportions then get matched. And I guess the take home for people is there's three weights. There's one for if you're just using information from the principal applicant, a secondary applicant weight, and an overall participant survey weight. So just keep that in mind when you're using the data. In terms of the structure of the data, we'll be providing more support in future around accessing to the data. But just to get a brief handle on it, the person period data set where you have the individual ID or person ID, a migrating unit ID, the wave ID, and the applicant type, just to give you a sense of the structure of it. And then we'll have new information coming in future waves, but that's how we'll be releasing wave one data. And we're hoping to have that released in the next few months. We will let you know through the channels that you've come to know about the seminar. There is a process that's yet to be fully finalised, but it's most likely 99% sure to be similar to all the other processes that happen with any longitudinal survey that Department of Social Services has. So you can apply to have access under a licence to use of the full data set, and you'll be provided with that data. And the main requirements around access to use is that you're competent to use the information, and that you've got a legitimate reason to use it, and you've got a research background sufficient to use it. So, so it will be made available very soon, and we're very excited about that prospect, and for people to have access to it. In terms of future activities, where to from here? Well, the data will be released very soon for wave one. It'll follow very shortly after for wave two release. So I anticipate that we will have a wave two release, if not by the end of this year, by early next year. And wave three will be collected at the end of the year and early next year. And we'll have a release most likely in 2016 or 17. We are considering asking participants in future waves about linking information, administrative information, so we can have a better access to and better understanding of their engagement with services, but we'll need to explore that. We'll need to consider the ethical implications of that. And I have also mentioned that we have and are collecting more information about the children in a child module, where we're specifically going to be asking questions of children who are about ages between 11 to 17 and of parents about their children, which is a very exciting area from my own perspective, being doing most of my research in terms of children's development. I think it's very exciting and very important when you're thinking about trying to develop and cater services and policies to support and protect children. So thank you very much for attending today's seminar. We will have some time for questions, but that's the end of the seminar. I mean, I want to make one final point of acknowledgement. I thank for the support of both departments and the support of our colleagues at Colmar Brutton Social Research. As you can see, it's a very complex and difficult study, and it's been terrific to work with them. And all the advisory groups have had input into the content. The ACE team have been fantastic, and it's been a true, in terms of degrees of difficulty with the survey, I've been involved in longitudinal studies for a while. This is a very high degree of difficulty, and they've done a terrific job. But lastly and importantly, the participants who've generated, generously given their time to provide us with this information. I really hope that it provides a good evidence base for debate and policy and service formation in the country. So thanks very much.